good evening, everyone. I'm Pam Stack, your host, and this is Authors on the Air. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. I hope you're listening to us live. If you are, would you please click the follow button? I'm not going to send you any email. I want to give a shout out before we get started to my underwriter, that's Poised Pen Productions, providing author gifts and promotional items, including graphics. You can find them on Facebook at Poised Pen Productions or on the web. I also want to thank our longtime sponsor, author D.D. Corbett. She wrote The Amaretto, a Florida Keys sailing adventure. You can find that on Amazon. And also a big thank you to author Robert Gregory Brown, who not only writes fine thrillers and suspense, but he is a very talented composer and musician. He created and plays our theme music. So thank you, Rob. Tonight, I'm very happy to be with a gentleman who has been awarded and nominated for many, many awards for several of his books. He was given the Seamus Award in 2013 for White Heat. He was a McCavity and an Anthony Award nominee for Howling at the Moon in 2015. He writes noir crime fiction. He is from L.A. I can't wait to talk to him and can't wait for you to hear him. I'm glad to welcome to the show Paul D. Marks. Hi, Paul. Welcome to Authors on the Air.
Hi, Pam. Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
I'm so glad that you're with me tonight. We've talked about doing this for a while, and finally, I'm finally able to get you on the schedule. It's a joy to have you here. Thank you. How is everything in California? Are you in the spots where you've gotten rain?
We did get some rain over the weekend. Of course, we don't have enough, but apparently the snowpack in Northern California is doing pretty good, so hopefully we'll be out of the drought soon.
Does it look like that? Is that what is predicted?
They're talking about that, and they're saying we still have 60 days left of El Nino, so God, I hope so, because being a noir guy, I like rain.
Yeah, I bet you do. Those dark, rainy, slick streets, right? I can just envision the street light on an asphalt road that's wet from the rain. Do I have the right image? The neon reflection, yeah. I have the right. I love the fact that you post a lot of pictures of Hollywood and of Los Angeles, very evocative of the noir genre, the noir crime fiction genre. Have you always been interested in writing crime fiction, Paul?
Well, I didn't start off writing crime fiction, but I gravitated towards that because it's what I like to watch and what I like to read, and pretty much these days it's about all I'm doing. Every once in a while I get an idea for something that's not crime fiction oriented, but it always goes on the back burner. So yeah, I've pretty much always been into it.
Tell me a little bit about you growing up and how you got interested in reading.
Well, I grew up in Los Angeles, and I like to say, although I'm getting less and less liking to say it, that I'm old enough to remember Los Angeles as it was when Raymond Chandler was writing about it. And
wow.
He was even still alive when I was a little kid. And it started changing in the 60s. You know, it started getting a lot of more tall buildings and things like that. But when I was growing up, it was like a big spread out small town. And, you know, it was very different than New York or San Francisco. I guess to some extent it still is, but it's getting more and more of that big city feel all the time. And, you know, growing up in L.A., I come from a multi-generation Los Angeles family. And,
wow.
You know, you would see all the locations that you'd see in the film noir movies. Or when I was a kid, my dad took me on the original Angel's Flight, which shows up in Kiss Me Deadly and several other film noirs. And, you know, so I got to experience a lot of the locations that were in the movies. And, you know, it was kind of a symbiotic thing. You know, one thing feeds off the other. And also growing up, there was a lot of movie studios, backlots everywhere. I don't know if people know that Century City used to all be 20th Century Fox backlot. And there was a bridge across Olympic Boulevard. The soundstage part of the lot is still there south of Olympic, but north of Olympic was their exterior set. So, you know, you'd just be driving down Santa Monica Boulevard and you'd see all these sets. You know, so between the kind of noir locations and the Hollywood connection, I think those are the things that really affected me growing up and kind of made me want to be a writer.
It's interesting. Were you a big reader as a kid?
I was as a little kid, you know, up till about maybe age 10 or 12. And then I guess I got more interested in girls and doing other things. I kind of didn't read much during my teen years, including what I was supposed to be reading for high school, although I probably read some of that stuff. But then after I got out of school, I started reading heavy again, and I love it. You know, I love movies, but there's something much more rich when you're reading a book. You know, you get so many more layers than most movies can offer you.
Sure, you have a lot more backstory also, don't you? Because a movie can only give you so much. They can pretty much focus on the main story and a few of the peripheral characters. But when you're reading good crime fiction, like you said, there are a lot of layers and there are a lot of backstories, correct?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, like I say, it's actually crime fiction movies or noir movies that brought me to crime fiction books. But the books do have much more layered nuances, and you can get into the characters' heads more and things like that. But one of my favorite writers is David Goodis, and the way I discovered him is Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall made a movie called Dark Passage that I'd seen several times, and after watching it, I decided, you know, I really like this movie. Who wrote the book? I knew it was based on a book, and I wasn't really familiar with Goodis. This was a long time ago, of course, so I ended up getting Dark Passage, the book, and reading that, and I fell in love with Goodis. He's one of my favorites. And, you know, so that and other movies kind of brought me to crime fiction as opposed to the other way around.
Interesting. What are some of the films that you think are classic noir?
Well, if I had to pick one noir to show to a Martian and say this is film noir, it would be Double Indemnity. I don't think anything, for my money, you know, I know other people might disagree, but for my money, that is the ultimate film noir. It has everything that film noir is known for. Another great one is Out of the Past. Postman Always Rings Twice. There's a B-noir that I really like a lot called Too Late for Tears with Elizabeth Scott that has some really good Los Angeles location shooting in it. And, you know, there's so many. But my three favorites are probably Out of the Past, Postman Always Rings Twice, and Double Indemnity, with Double Indemnity being hands and fists of anything.
How do you know what the elements of noir film are? How do you describe it?
Well, you know, there's a lot of, you know, in classic film noir, people think about the shadows, the lighting, the low key lighting, the low angles, the femme fatale, things like that. But to me, and also black and white, but to me, what really makes noir is you have a character who is flawed and basically trips over their own Achilles heel because of greed or lust or something like that, and that's what brings them down. The classic example, again, being Fred McMurray in Double Indemnity, where he falls for Barbara Stanwyck and her sexy anklet, and but he had to have it in him to begin with. You know, that was just the excuse to bring it out.
Now, I've been told that there is a style that noir can be stylistic. It's a style of film, and also that it is a writing style, and they're quite different. That noir is exactly as you said. It's a guy who can't really get out of his own way. I mean, he's a beautiful loser. So I understand what you're saying about the films and the setting, the way the film is made, black and white, you know, the femme fatale, all that. That would be the stylistic portion of it. But you prefer to look at noir from a storytelling point. Is that right?
Well, I think overall, yeah, because there's a guy named John Dahl, a director and writer in Hollywood, who did a bunch of three film noirs like in the 80s or 90s, Kill Me Again, Red Rock West, and well, right now the third one escapes me. But, you know, they were Last Seduction. They were kind of classic film noirs, but they were in color. But what made them noir more than anything to me is the stories. Again, the person tripping over their own feet. And to me, that's the key element. You can have, you know, people say, well, can you have a color noir? Can you make a film noir today? You know, Body Heat is not today, but, a, you know, a modern color film noir that really is like a retelling of Double Indemnity.
Right.
And, you know, but what makes it noir to me, yeah, the lighting helps, the angles help, all that stuff. Sometimes you have a first-person narrator, voiceover, or whatever. But really what makes it is the story. And it to me, it's about a guy or a woman who, you know, through whatever weaknesses they have, it brings them down. And that, to me, is the key element of noir. Everything else is, you know, like icing on the cake.
What did you do after you got out of high school? What kind of work did you do that led you up to being a writer?
Well, I did a lot of different things. I traveled around. I was overseas for a while. I did a bunch of different stuff. And I think what led me to being a writer is, you know, I always kind of wanted to be a writer. This is going to sound a little bit silly, you know. When I was a kid, I used to play with army men. You know, I'd move them across the floor, and
sure.
You know, it was like a whole movie I'd make. You know, I'd have them talk, and I'd set up Tinker Toys. So instead of like they were in a real war or something, I'd set up Tinker Toys like Klieg lights, and I'd pretend they were in a movie. So I always had that kind of bug to do that. And when I got out of college, you know, I majored in cinema or film, whatever, and I got out of college, and I did some articles for one of the local newspapers, and at the same time, I was trying to break into Hollywood and do that kind of thing, and I got in. The thing that got me in was a rewrite of a comedy script that never ended up seeing the light of day, which is kind of the story of my life, but...
Not anymore, my friend. You're an award-winning crime fiction writer, so that is not the case anymore.
Well, that's
kind of took you to writing, did it? To writing
yeah.
Your book, your great American novel.
Well, I haven't written that one yet, but it's on the back burner.
But when you think about it, noir is a very is that a truly an American style of writing and film, or was this, did it start someplace else? Was it a French thing where it started?
Well, you know, it goes back all the way to German Expressionism in terms of the look of film noir, and then during World War II, a lot of German emigres came here from Europe because of Hitler and all that kind of stuff, and a lot
sure.
of them settled in Hollywood, so they brought that style, that visual style with them. But what I've read or heard is that the actual content of film noir was kind of a reaction to World War II, where people were more cynical. And at the time, they just thought they were making B-movies or crime movies. You know, the term noir hadn't been coined until either the 50s or early 60s, I can't remember, by a French critic. And yeah, I think the actual noir genre was invented in America. I think I read something where Roger Ebert, I could be wrong on who said America gave three genres to film, westerns, film noir, and now I can't remember what the third one is. But I do think it is an American genre. I think the French were heavily influenced by it. What happened is that during the war, they couldn't get American movies. So after the war, they got a glut of these low-budget, black-and-white movies that the studios were putting out that was often were the bottom half of a double feature. And so they got this glut of them all at one time, and it seemed to, you know, coin a phrase, like a genre to them. And they coined the term film noir, and you know, they made movies that I guess could be classified as noir. But, yeah, I think it started in America, yeah.
Interesting. So we can really claim the best film noir and noir authors, then, I'm imagining. You know that we have two shows in this network that are directed specifically toward lovers of noir and pulp and flash and so on, Noir on the Radio and Skid Row Chatter with host Tom Pitts. So those particular shows have been fun for me to produce because it has opened up another whole generation of writers to me, and I happen to love that genre very, very much. Although it was not, when I was reading crime fiction in the beginning, it wasn't called noir. I guess now it's everything's subgenred out, isn't it, Paul? We've got a million subgenres for everything. Instead of it just being fiction, we have all these different categories. I don't know how that happened, but I really enjoyed the genre a lot. So you're a little bit maybe ahead of your time with the resurgence of noir, would you say?
Well, I don't know. I haven't thought of it that way. But
how long have you been writing?
Well, I've been writing fiction for probably since about the 80s or 90s. Like I say, I was doing some stuff in Hollywood. I was doing a lot of rewriting and never getting screen credit. So I wanted to be able to do something, I guess, for my ego, where I actually saw my name on something. And also in Hollywood, there's a million chefs often spoiling the stew. So I wanted to do something where it would be more my vision, you know, more what I want to say and less what somebody else thinks, you know, an audience is, you know, going to go for. So I wrote an early novel that was kind of a satire that actually had been picked up at a major publisher, but like the story of my life got swept out. They got a new editorial staff, and they swept out all the old editorial staff's acquisitions. And it was a satire about somebody trying to make it in Hollywood, of all things. And the humor was dated. So after that, I kind of drifted more into writing mystery or noir. Not always noir, but definitely mystery. And started with a lot of short stories and, you know, eventually started getting published in various places. And
you still write short stories, though, don't you?
Yeah, I like it. And actually, in some ways, short stories are harder to write than novels because you have to do so much more in such a short space and you have to get everything.
I think it's amazing. People who write short stories or flash fiction to me are geniuses. To tell a story in such, using such an economy of words and such a short amount of words, you know, so few pages. To me, that's amazing. And I've read some terrific short stories and novellas. I've listened to some just fascinating flash fiction that pretty much encapsulates an entire book in 1,000 words. So to me, that's a special kind of talent. And you know, I really commend and honor any writer who does that. It's not an easy thing to do, but I'm so fascinated by it, which is why the network allowed me to create those two shows, because I'm fascinated by it. And apparently there are a lot of others too. Let's talk about your first book that was published. Tell me the name.
White Heat?
Yeah, White Heat is a really, really well-known, you've done very, very well with that. That was your award-winning book, correct? That is the one that you won the Seamus for. Am I right about that?
Yeah. Yes.
Tell the listeners the little bit of the story of White Heat, please.
Well, White Heat takes place in 1992 during the Rodney King riots. And it's about a detective who considers himself a fuck-up because he's been told that by his father, you know, that he's just a fuck-up all his life.
Right.
So So he, a guy walks into his office and he wants to hire him for a job to find an old high school roommate, and not roommate, but friend. And he, the detective says, oh, man, this will be a cinch. Even in the days before the internet, you know, he has a friend who works in the DMV because he's cultivated all these friendships, and he knows he can track down the person quickly. So he says, come back in a couple days, and he gets the person's name and address from his friend in the DMV. The guy comes back in a couple days. He takes a couple $100 from him, doesn't even do any paperwork, nothing like that. And he thinks, you know, I've made a quick couple $100. The guy's gone. And he's reading the paper a couple days later, and he finds that the person that he tracked down for his client has been murdered. And he knows that he inadvertently had something to do with that because he helped the guy find the address of the victim. So he feels guilty, and he decides he's going to try to track the guy down. But like I said, he had no paperwork, so he doesn't know where to begin. He figures he'll start by going to her apartment, and then eventually he ends up at her house. And she's an upcoming young black actress, and her family lives in South Central Los Angeles. So he ends up down in South Central the day that the riots break out, and he's caught in the middle of that and has to escape that. The case is on hold, and it kind of takes off.
No spoilers,
I'm sorry?
Okay? No spoilers.
No.
it's you have woven a very unique story in with a true story. I'm sure that out of those riots that were real, many stories have come forth, but yours was awarded a Seamus. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Were you stunned?
Stunned in what way?
Were you stunned when they announced your name? Or did know? Did you know that was going to be your year?
You know, I didn't. I hoped it would, and I thought it was a good book, and it was getting good reviews. It got a good review from Publishers Weekly and Midwest Review and other places, and other people were, you know, giving it good reviews. So, and it was selling well. It was doing really well. And, you know, but I didn't know. I was hoping, you know, I would get some attention for it. So, yeah, I guess you could say I was stunned. And that year, the Seamus Awards always kind of piggyback on to BoucherCon. So wherever BoucherCon
right.
is, the Seamus Awards are in the same city at the same time, although a separate
right.
thing.
They're
and that year, the awards were in Albany, New York.
Uh-huh.
And I told my wife, I say, you know, Albany, you know, like the last place on earth I ever thought I wanted to go.
In the very northern part, upstate New York, I know, where they had to bus you to the conference from the hotel.
Yeah.
I know, I remember.
Yeah,
funny.
It was a different kind of BoucherCon because they didn't have a central hotel where everything was taking
right.
place. It was in a convention center. But what we did is we flew into Connecticut and rented a car because there were no direct flights. And we drove through some of the eastern states, and that was nice. The leaves were starting to change. And we actually ended up, you know, always when we go to these conventions, we take a couple of extra days at the end to kind of explore the cities. And like I said, Albany is not a place I ever – it wasn't on my bucket list, let's put it that way.
Well, there's not a lot going on in Albany, that's true. Well, you go to the capital, I suppose, right?
Well, we ended up liking it. We actually ended up – you know, it had that kind of quaint – New England feel, very different from New York City. So
Oh, yes.
We actually liked it, and of course it made it all the better that I won the award. And
absolutely,
that was
that's
very
why you
exciting.
Liked it.
That was a,
that's
a
why
real.
That's why you liked it. That's funny.
That,
well, you wouldn't
helped.
Like it. I've been there in the winter, in the bitter cold winter, and it's not fun. So I will tell you, you were there at a good time. I want to take a break right now and to remind everyone, this is a trademark copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. My guest tonight is Seamus Award winner and other award nominated, Paul D. Marks. We're talking about his first book, White Heat. Paul's going to take calls from you if you're interested in calling in and talking about film noir or the writing of noir books or any of your favorite authors. Or if you have questions, give us a call at 347-633-9609. As a matter of fact, whoever the first caller is, I'm going to gift you a copy of White Heat by Paul D. Marks, his Shameless award-winning book. Paul, you're fresh off a victory from the Shameless, and you get back to work. What's the next book? You wrote, I think after that, you wrote for Ellery Queen, didn't you? That was when you wrote Howling at the Moon for Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine?
Well, somewhere around there, yeah. I had, in the November 2014 issue of Ellery Queen, Howling at the Moon appeared. And one of my goals, you know, I've set a lot of different goals, but one of them was always to get into Ellery Queen and Alfred Hitchcock. And so that was my first story in Ellery Queen, and I was really thrilled about that. And, in fact, they just put up the other day a when I went to BoucherCon, I met with the editor of Ellery Queen, Janet Hutchings, and read the story Howling at the Moon for them, and they just put it up the other day. So I'm sure you can get that link on their website if anybody wants to hear me reading it. But Howling at the Moon is an interesting story, and I was shocked. I remember when I got the I woke up one day. I sleep during the day, and I write, and, you know, I'm a night person. So I woke up during the day, you know, in the afternoon sometime, and I had a ton of emails, and they're all saying congratulations. And I'm going, what the fuck? I don't know what the fuck they're talking about. I don't know what. You know, it was for the Anthony Award. You know, it was congratulations right. being nominated for the Anthony. And, it came out of the blue. I mean, I couldn't have been more happy. And then a few weeks later, the same thing happened for the Anthony. So the story was nominated for both of those.
For the McCavity.
McCavity,
yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
And
how great.
You know, so that was really thrilling. And then it also came in number 7 that year in the Ellery Queen Readers Poll Award. So that was really exciting, too. And since then, I've sold them another story that, you know, I'm not sure when it's going to be out. But, you know, it's just. It's great.
That's Ghost of Bunker Hill, right?
Yeah, uh-huh.
Yeah, very good. Well, you're rolling right along with your short stories in your book. So now you've got a new book that you're going to bring out, and that is, I first want to ask you about Free Fall. Tell me about that.
Well, Free Fall is a short story that was originally published in Gary Lovisi's Hard-Boiled Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And that story to me is what I would consider a real noir story, again, about a guy who trips over his own feet. And it's about a guy who comes to L.A., reaches the end of the road at the end of Route 66, which is right around where the Santa Monica Pier is, and he meets that femme fatale that changes his life. But I also put out a single version of that on Amazon, and it's also in my collection of 5 noir and mystery stories called L.A. Late at Night. And I really like it. I think it's a good story.
So now comes Vortex, the new book. Tell us about Vortex.
Well, Vortex is a novella that originally I was contracted with a publisher of novellas to do, and they kind of went belly up, so I had to do something else with it. But the original impetus for it was that. But what I wanted to do with Vortex is there's a whole, like you were talking before about subgenres of subgenres,
uh-huh.
There's a whole subgenre.
Sure.
Of film noir about returning war vets after World War II. And one of my favorites of those is Somewhere in the Night. And I kind of wanted to do an updating of that genre. So Vortex is about an Afghan war vet who comes home and finds more trouble here than he found over there. And him and his buddies, they skimmed money. Americans were giving money to Afghan warlords to not grow drugs and to do other things, you know, to get them to be on our side. And so they skimmed some of the money that was going to those guys. And they come back here, and his friends think he's got the money. And we don't know if he does or not, but either way, he's changed his mind. He doesn't want it anymore, but they think he's got it, and they go after him. So that's pretty much, you know, the impetus for that story. And, you know, it plays out how he deals with that situation.
Interesting. Sounds fascinating. Not something I've read, and it sounds like something I need to read. I've not read a story like that. So I'm always interested in hearing a new take on an, or a new twist on an old story, which it sounds like it is. I want to quote something that you wrote on your website. And by the way, go to pauldmarks.com to find out more about Paul and his books. But Stephen Bingen, who was the author of MGM Hollywood's Greatest Backlot, said, "You had the distinction, dubious though it may be, of being the last person to have shot a film on the fabled MGM backlot before it bit the dust to make way for condos." I think that's fascinating. Can you tell us what film you were working on then?
I was doing a musical called Showbiz, and I added the dubious. He didn't say that.
Okay.
But,
okay.
He, you know, I never claimed to be the last person to shoot a film on the MGM backlot, but he and two other guys did this book, MGM Hollywood's Greatest Backlot, and they determined that I was the last person to shoot there. So, you know, MGM back in the day was the biggest studio of all. I mean, it was the Rolls Royce of studios with the biggest stars. They had five different backlots, I believe, in Culver City, along with their main lot, which was sound stages. And they had sold off the lots one after the other, and the only one left was lot number two, which was across the street from the main backlot. And the sets were still standing and everything. And, you know, I was doing this film, and I was able to film there, and it was really exciting to be filming on the same streets that Clark Gable and Myrna Loy and all these people had walked on, and on some of the sets from like Philadelphia Story or Singing in the Rain and stuff like that. And you know, in talking with Steve Bingen, that's what he said, that I'm the last person to have filmed there. So it's a distinction, but a dubious one. And, you know, I took some souvenirs off.
You turned off the lights, right? You turned off the lights on that for the last time.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah, we turned off the lights and closed the door on our way out.
There you go. What kind of souvenirs did you take with you?
Well, I took a brick off the Andy Hardy set that my wife made me throw out. I figured it was a famous brick, you know, it was a movie star brick, but she made me toss it. They had also recently filmed their the Dino De Laurentiis version of King Kong, and I took a torch off of that set, which I still have, and a sign from the old MGM train station. They had a whole train station on the back lot of it, you know, so I have a sign that says something like, "Passengers, keep your hands in the windows," or something, and probably some other stuff that I've forgotten about over the years that, you know, I'll be cleaning out the garage and come across one of these days.
Do you have a lot of memorabilia?
I have some. Mostly, you know, I was collecting Beatles stuff for a long time and rock and roll stuff. I have a lot of lobby cards and movie posters in terms of movie memorabilia, and I collect toys. Yeah, I'm a pack rat, you know. We just cleared out our storage space. We didn't really clear it out. We just moved everything into our garage, so I can't park in the garage anymore. And, yeah, I got a ton of books, DVDs. I still have vinyl records. I mean, you name it, you know. I'm the problem. My wife.
Do you have any scripts?
You mean, like, classic movie scripts and stuff?
Mm-hmm.
I used to have a ton of that stuff. I might still have a few, but I know in one of our cleanings I got rid of some of that stuff. I gave it away to people, but I still have a few. Yeah, they're here somewhere.
Are they not valuable? I mean, aren't there people who love that type of memorabilia?
There are, and when I gave them away, you know, I knew that, but, you know, sometimes when you're involved in something, it's not quite have the, you know, I don't know what the word is. You're used to it. You know, it's just that your everyday stuff. So it doesn't, you know,
it doesn't
have that.
It's not the thrill that it is for someone who's a collector or to whom it might be new, I suppose.
Yeah, something like that. And, you know, I still have some stuff, you know, probably in the garage, but I don't remember what at this point, you know. And
this is so funny.
It's, you know.
That's so funny. Paul, you edited a book, Coast to Coast, Murder from Sea to Shining Sea, with another author, correct?
With Andy Mapp.
Yeah. You had quite a lot of really, really terrific writers as a part of that book. They're almost all award-winning. Did you enjoy the editing process for that anthology?
Well, it's a little bit intimidating to edit some of those big name writers. But yeah, I enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun, and we did get some really good and well-known writers for it, and I think it's a really great collection. And in fact, right now we're working on a second volume. That one was Coast to Coast, Murder from Sea to Shining Sea. And right now we're working on Coast to Coast, Private Eyes from Sea to Shining Sea, that'll also be coming out from Down and Out Books probably late this year.
Wonderful. And so that's fun for you. Do you like reading the stories and you just getting into the meat of them? And do you see something new and exciting? Do you see any writers that you really like coming out now?
Well, yeah. And reading the stories for Coast to Coast, you know, you're always worried, you know, what if I don't like this one? You know, how am I going to say that to somebody? But, you know, that didn't happen, luckily. And I just finished judging a major contest, major award, and I was judging in the short story category. And let me tell you, that was a lot of reading. I mean, we basically read every short story that came out in every magazine, from Ellery Queen and Alfred Hitchcock to The Strand to book collections to little, you know, just almost everything, you know. And you know, as with everything, it's on a bell curve. There's some really good stuff, some not so good stuff, and most of the stuff is in between. But I found a lot of authors that, you know, I think I'll probably end up seeking out more of their stuff. And, you know, it's also hard because some of the people you know, and you have to try to be really objective. And I try, you know, I really try to do a good job and not let prejudices, whether I like somebody or dislike somebody, come into the picture.
Sure. Who do you like now? Who are you reading now and hearing about that you really like?
I really like Matt Coyle. And
so do I.
I'm sorry?
I like Matt a lot. He's a great guy.
He is a good guy. And
he's a great writer,
I read his
too.
First...
I love his books. Yes.
Matt and I were asked to read at the same Los Angeles Noir at the Bar a couple of years ago, I guess. And we bought each other's books at that time, and we met each other, and we've been friends ever since. And I really loved his first book. I just was blown away by it. And, you know, he's got another one out, Night Tremors, that's also really great. And
he's been a guest on this show, and he calls in regularly too. I'm surprised. As a matter of fact, Matt, if you're listening, call in and say hi to Paul. He generally calls in, and he's a terrific guy, and I really have enjoyed having him on the show. And I've enjoyed his books very, very much. I think he's very talented.
I agree.
Who else do you like?
Well, I like a lot of, you know, different people. I like Craig Buck's book, Go Down Hard, that was also really good.
Fantastic. And he won. There's Matt. I'm telling you, he's calling in right now. Hold on. Did you hear me calling you?
Well, you know, I was about to call in, and then also something about it. I said, like, I thought I can't call in now.
Sure you can. That's why I said, okay, Matt, come on, call in. I know you're listening. There you go, Paul. See, ask it and you shall receive. There's Matt.
Hey, Matt.
Hey, buddy. Hey, you know, I do have a question for the folks out there, though. I asked this. I was on a panel with Craig Faustus Buck, who all of us know, who did a lot of time in Hollywood. And I asked him. I said, "Well, because I write a very scattershot way, I call it blank paging. In L.A., it's known as seat of the pants, or most places around the country." So I asked Craig. I said, "You must really outline, you know, with all your experience." He goes, "You know, when I got away from having to do all that, it really freed me up, and I'm a complete pantser now." So I wanted to ask Paul what his situation was when he writes a story or a novel. You outline, or
I'm absolutely in the same boat as Craig. I hate outlining. You used to have to, you know, to do the Hollywood stuff, you had to do a treatment or an outline. And I don't think that way. You know, I like to just sit down and go by the seat of my pants. And because mostly what I did in Hollywood was rewriting, pretty much all I did, it gave me a good feel for structure and what works and what doesn't. So what I do is I do what I call let the characters talk and walk, which is basically seat of the pants. And I often write the first draft of a novel or a short story in screenplay format, you know, exterior, beach, day, whatever. And I don't put a lot of description in. I just want to get to the plot and the characters, and then I hone it as I go along. But no, I'm with Craig. I hate outlining. I couldn't stand it when I had to do it, and I can't stand the thought of it now. Even if after the fact, if somebody asks for a summary of something, I just hate it. I like to do it by the seat of my pants, and I just chip away at it, you know, one draft at a time. So I end up having a lot of drafts, and the early drafts are very rough and not very good, but it works for me. And like I say, you know, when I had to do the outlining and the treatments and that kind of stuff, I just don't think that way, and it was very hard for me to do that off the cuff.
Well, let me ask you both something, you know, because I now have spoken to both of you. Craig was just on here not too long ago. Matt talked to Craig also when he was on. You know, and this is what I've heard, and it may or may not be true. It's different for everyone. I know writers who their first draft gets edited along the way, and their first draft becomes their final draft. But I think a lot of new writers are a little concerned because they go back and read what they've written, and they say, "Oh, this is really crap," and I just throw it away. But the fact of the matter is, aren't you just kind of throwing your words out there the first time around, just getting your thoughts down on paper? And it doesn't matter if it's really not structured the right way. It's just, you got to get it out. You got to get the story out, get your characters named and so on. What do you think, Paul?
Yeah, that's what works for me, you know, because I feel like when I'm doing that, I'm getting to know the character, and I don't have to keep anything that they say or anything that they do, but it gives me an idea who they are because I let them take over the story, and then I go back and I edit and I cut. One of the best pieces of writing advice that I ever got was don't rewrite as you go along, because you end up sitting on the same sentence or paragraph or whatever for a day or 2 days, you know, trying to get every word right. That should come later. Just get it down on paper, see what you have. And, you know, it's kind of like stream of consciousness. Just let it flow and edit later. And that's what I do. I go through draft after draft, you know, and eventually I get something that I actually like.
What about you, Matt? I'm sorry, I should really introduce you. Ladies and gentlemen, for those of you who don't know, this is Matt Coyle, who's also a fantastic writer. He's have gifted me both of his books, which are in my treasured collection on my shelf right now. Matt is, I'm so honored that he's a regular caller to the show. He knows everybody and everybody knows him. Matt, when you're writing, do you do the same thing when you get your, when you're just sitting down to start a new book? What do you do?
Well, thanks for the compliments, but clearly I'm not that good a writer because I often do what Paul has recommended not to do. I do revise as I go. There are times when I'll sit on a phrase for a half hour, but there are other times when I will just say, well, as I should, I'll fix that later and just roll, go with the spewing it out. But I do revise every day what I've written the day before, and then certain parts of the book I'll go back. Because I don't really know the story. I know the beginning, the middle, and the end, but I don't know all the other stuff until I write
right.
it. And the characters, as Paul was saying, the characters, you know, walk and talk and kind of take over. So I will go back occasionally and revise even things 50 or 60 pages before, now that something's changed in the story. But I do revise as I go, but I do also agree that you need to lay tracks, as a woman I work with, Carolyn Wheat, says. You got to lay the tracks. Don't worry so much about the first draft. It's probably not going to be what you want it to be, and you can always fix it. And I don't know the story until I'm done anyway, and then I have to go back and do more revisions.
So I see two sides of the same coin, though. What I see is, in the way Paul does it, you kind of do this blitzkrieg through your manuscript. You get beginning, middle, and end. You get it down there. And I understand that well. So, but let's say you go back and you're going to your second draft, Paul, whereas Matt is looking back on what he's written already and editing that and then moving forward. If you have a major change, if you read your first draft, you're saying, well, crap, this doesn't work at all. You know, I've got no story arc. I've got no tension is building. I don't have, you know, the character's not making any sense. What if that, does that ever throw you off and change the entire tenor of the story?
Well, it does. You have to, you know, make those changes. I just don't make them in the first draft. I might make a note, you know, that I want to do this or that the next draft, and then I'll do that. I just recently wrote a story called Nature of the Beast that is going to be published in Beat to a Pulp sometime in the next few months. And I totally changed the ending on that story. I don't want to say what it is, but from the early draft, you know, it just wasn't working, you know, and I knew it wasn't working. I couldn't figure out what it was. But in going through it again and again, you know, eventually it clicked, and I changed the ending, and it all seemed to come together. So I do make major changes, of course, but I just, you know, I guess I'm very goal-oriented. I don't count words. You know, some people, you know, want to do X number of words during a writing session. I don't do that. But I do like to see progress. You know, when I read a book, I'm always checking to see where the next chapter is or how far from the end I am. And when I'm writing, I'm doing the same thing. You know, how much have I done? And so I guess I work that. That might come from Hollywood writing where, you know, you have to write relatively quickly and, you know, get the pages done. So, but I do make changes. I make major changes. And then, you know, at some point I go back and I try to work on the words, you know, where I try to take out right constructions or, you know, make better descriptions. Coming from screenwriting, description was very hard for me. Because in a screenplay, there's very little description.
Right.
And that's one of the things I like about writing prose is that I can do a little bit more description. Although even today, people are saying people don't want to read that. They want the plot, you know.
I don't know if that's true or not. I think it depends on the story. I mean, I think if you have good, strong characters, then there's nothing wrong with the prose of it all. I'm one who doesn't care about the length of a book. I want the story and the characters just to affect me. You know, I read a lot of books every year. I start off with 800. I winnow it down to 400 that I actually end up reading. And I got to get grabbed in the first couple pages. Really, I don't give it any more time than that. Actually, to be honest with you, I've got to see it on the cover, and I've got to look at the synopsis of the book on the back jacket. If I'm not grabbed right then and there, it's gone. And if it's an ugly jacket, I don't even bother. I can't help it. I don't have time to take a chance that someone who is not conscious of what their cover looks like and how it affects the content of the book. You know, if they're not wrapping their gift nicely, their merchandise, if it's packaged poorly, I'm afraid the content is going to be poor. And it's probably a bad assumption, but that's just how I am as a reader. You know, I try to, when I talk to debut novelists or people who are writing, I always say, from a reader's standpoint, you better get my eye. 2 million books are on, there's over 5 million books on Amazon right now. So if you're cruising through and books and you're trying to pick something out and you have a thumbnail of something, it better damn well catch your eye. And then you better have a snappy synopsis on it too, wouldn't you think?
Oh, I absolutely agree. I was looking at a book the other day. I came across a book either on Facebook or Amazon. I don't remember exactly. And the title of it was Soldiers Something. And there was no apostrophe in the soldiers, and it should have been possessive. And I turned to my wife and I said, come here, look at this. What's wrong with this? Why am I never going to read this book? And she caught it right away, you know, because I said, you know, if they can't even get the cover right, you know the inside's going to be a major mess.
Right.
So I agree with you. You have to have a good cover, a good presentation, a good synopsis. And hopefully a good hook.
Paul, you're talking about, you know, the don't write prose. There shouldn't be a lot of that in there. I just don't agree. You know, what was it 2 years ago when Terry Shames put out I Am Pilgrim? It was 700 pages. I thought it was one of the best books I've ever read. And I read that on my Kindle and was not aware of how many pages there were because, quite frankly, it doesn't concern me in the least. But if something is really good and it ends, I'm really ticked. I want it to be longer. But I'm gratified at having read a really well-done story. Matt, what's your take on it?
You know what? I was doing a little revision there.
Go do your revisions, Matt. You know,
I was going to drop off because it's Paul's hour, but I didn't want to hang up while you were talking. But
No. I extended the time. We have plenty of time. Don't worry about it. I'm not cutting Paul off at all. I just extended the time a little bit. So we'll run over our allotted time. Don't worry about it. You know, sometimes it's good to be the queen when you have your own show. Matt, are you currently writing something new? Am I going to see a book from you soon?
Yeah, well, I'm of course, I thought I was done with my revisions that I was going to talk to my editor about on Friday, and then there was something I wanted to look at, and it needs to be fixed, so I have one last little revision to make.
There you go.
I'll send it back to her, yeah.
All right, can't wait to talk to you again, buddy. Come and co-host a show with me sometime.
Sounds good. I enjoyed it.
All right. Okay, thanks an awful lot, Matt. I appreciate you calling me in. Matt Coyle, everyone. Thanks, Matt. Good night.
Thanks, Matt.
I could go on with you forever about the craft of writing and structure and everything else. What comes first for you, the character or the story?
Before I get to that, I'd like to just say one thing about the last thing you were talking about the description or the length of books. I agree with you. I'm not one who says plot, plot, plot. I like the luxury of able to do more in the book than, you know, but I hear people say plot, 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 and you know, I think that's kind of sad because, you know, obviously you want a plot. I want a plot too, and I want a fast moving plot, but I think, you know, it's nice to be able. I like Raymond Chandler because I like his descriptions, among other things.
Yeah, the narrative is important, I think. Let's take another call, okay?
Sure.
Hi, area code 310, you're live on the air. Who's this?
Hi, this is Sarah Chen. I just wanted to say hi.
Sarah. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Hi.
How you doing?
Sarah, One of my favorite authors who does flash fiction like nobody's business. How are you tonight, Sarah Chen?
Oh, I'm good. Thanks. How are you guys doing?
We're great.
Good.
You got a question for Paul?
Not really. I just wanted to call and say hi. I've always kind of lurked on these radio shows, and then I have to walk my dog. But now I thought, well, I would love to just call and say hello to Paul. And I just want to. Yeah, he's such a great writer. I just always loved his short stories in the Sisters in Crime anthologies. His stories always stood out to me, so.
Paul, you know what happens with Sarah? She's so funny because she's, you know, far away from me. And when I do my podcast, the next day after I've posted the podcast, she always says, "Oh, I didn't have a chance to listen." She always does that to me every time on Facebook. She says, "Oh, darn, I'm going to have to go listen to the podcast now. I didn't listen to the live show." So I'm so glad you're calling in, Sarah.
Well, I'm glad she was listening tonight. Thanks, Sarah.
When
yeah,
are you
I
out?
Will.
When's your book coming out? When is your book going to be out?
Apparently it's May 16th. I think that's the set release date. So,
hot damn,
in a few months.
All right, so you got to come
back.
Yeah,
I'm excited.
And do your own show with me, yeah? Never mind being on with all the other guys. So you've got to come on and just be with me separately, okay?
Yeah, definitely. I forget sharing. It's just going to be me and you.
There you go. It'll be girls' night out. Absolutely. For everybody, this is Sarah Chen. She writes just killer noir stuff. Great flash fiction. Go and find her on Facebook. Do you have a website, Sarah? I can't remember.
I do. It's just sarahmchen.com.
Right. S-A-R-A-H-M Chen. So go and find her, read her stuff. She's really great, really, really great. I'm so glad you called in, Sarah. Thank you. And,
Sarah.
Okay.
Sure.
Talk to you soon. Go walk your dog.
Oh, I will. She's staring at me right now. So
well, wait till the show is over.
All right. Bye, Sarah.
All right. Bye. Bye, Paul.
Bye, Sarah. Thanks for calling.
Sure. I'll talk.
That's fun. I like Sarah very much. She has such a really good sense of story. I just really like listening to her read. So
I agree with you completely.
Yeah, yeah. Prior to us taking Sarah's call, I was asking you which comes first, the character or the storyline. What is it in your case?
You know, it really depends on the story. Sometimes the character will come first, sometimes the story will come first. Like in the case of Vortex, like I said, I wanted to do something about an updating of the returning war vet genre.
Right.
So in that basic concept came first and the character came afterwards. You know, each story dictates its own thing, and I have a story called Dead Man's Curve where I have a character that I really like a lot. His name is Ray Hood, and in that case, the character came first. He's a kind of burned out rock and roller, always on the fringes. You know, he played backup with some bands like Jan and Dean, not in their heyday, but later, and now he's a burned out druggie, and I just love that character. And one of the things in that story is there's kind of a slower section where we get into his character and the plot kind of slows down for a while. And I thought, you know, that they were going to cut that out when they published it, but they left it in. And I was really happy because that's a character that I really like and I might want to revisit again. In my story, Bunker Hill, or Ghost of Bunker Hill, that is going to be an Ellery Queen, there's a character in there named Howard Hamm that I also really like. But in that case, the location came first. Sometimes the location sparks the idea, and Bunker Hill is an area of Los Angeles that was L.A.'s first wealthy neighborhood. It's just near downtown L.A. And after World War I, it became decrepit. People started moving farther and farther west, you know, and now West L.A. is kind of the wealthy area, and they had these gorgeous Victorian mansions in Bunker Hill, and they wanted to redevelop the area. In fact, they flattened a lot of the hills. But I had gone there exploring just as it was being torn down. I stole some stuff out of some of those Victorian houses, too. You know, you can see a lot of Bunker Hill in old film noirs like Criss Cross and Kiss Me Deadly Again. And there's a very low-budget film noir called Angel's Flight that's all shot around Bunker Hill. Another one, Cry Danger with Vic Powell, has a lot of good Bunker Hill locations. And I love the area. So, you know, sometimes the location will actually inspire an idea. So partly it could be plot or it could be character. You know, it can be anything. I mean, you know, they just, people ask, where do you get your ideas? And they just pluck, you know, they're just in the air. You just have to see them.
Well, I have a question about your ideas. So sometimes you come up with a character name, or sometimes you get inspired by a location. So the first question I have is, do you ever go to a location after you form the idea for a story? That's the first thing I want to know. So say you have an idea for a story and you think, I want to set this at, you know, such and such and such and such a place. Do you go to that place in L.A. and walk it?
Well, sometimes I do, but more likely what happens is I've been to the location and that will spark the idea, okay. You know, rather than going afterwards. But sometimes, you know, you want to go to see what it's like so you can describe it as it is presently, you know, instead of
okay.
how you remember it or something like
all
that.
Right.
So that, again, works.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off.
That's okay. I'm done.
So my next question to you is, you have a lot of ideas, obviously. Your mind is, you're not lacking ideas or inspiration. The things you see, obviously, you said you're like sixth generation Los Angelino, and so you've got, you know, this is in your blood. This is, you know, this city very well. You have no problem conjuring up story ideas. But the question is, how do you know which one to pluck out of your mind and begin writing about?
That is a really difficult thing to do, because I'll get a new idea. And of course, the minute I get the idea, I'm hot to trot on that idea. And then I get another idea, and I'm hot to trot on that idea. And, you know, you just have to start working with something and see if it is working. Sometimes you have to let something gestate in your mind for a while, and, you know, because you just don't have enough there to grab onto. And other times, you know, it just almost comes fully formed. And, you know, sometimes I have to be honest. Sometimes there's commercial considerations.
Absolutely.
So, you know, yeah, you want to work on something that you think people will actually buy or look at or like. And, you know, occasionally you work on something that's just a labor of love and you hope that people will like it in the end. But ultimately, you know, you just work on something, whatever is sparking in your mind at that time, you know. And it just depends. It depends, you know, where I'm at and what's going on in my
sure.
life, I think.
Interesting. Very interesting. When you're writing noir, are the names of the characters important? And is the title of the book important? I know
I
that
think,
book titles are very iffy. It's hard for people to grab on to book titles, but I'm talking specifically in the noir subgenre of crime fiction. I don't know if you want to have, do you need to have a certain type of a name of a character? Do you understand what I'm saying, Paul? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. And I absolutely, character names and story titles are very important. I think the story title, you know, certain words and things are evocative of, you know, at least, you know, when I see a title and I look at it, like back to Matt Coyle, you know, Yesterday's Echo. That is
right.
a title that just you know, jumps out at me, and it says so much. There's so much happening. You know, yesterday's echo. What is the echo of yesterday that's happening? And I know it's going to be a mystery detective story, so I know that there's, you know, something from the past that's going to come back and bite the main character. But, yeah, you know, like White Heat. You know, my novel White Heat takes place during the Rodney King riots, and even though there's a Jimmy Cagney movie named White Heat, which I may have borrowed the title from, I thought it was very appropriate for that story because my story is about a white detective who goes into a black neighborhood and, you know, all kinds of things start happening. So, you know, there's a little double meaning to the title.
Right, right.
And, you know, in Howling at the Moon, the Ellery Queen story, there's a character in there named Bud Traven. And some people caught that reference because there's a little bit of similarity between Howling at the Moon and Treasure of Sierra Madre. And the man who wrote the book that Treasure of Sierra Madre is based on is B. Traven. So, you know, not that my character Bud Traven has anything to do with Treasure of Sierra Madre or the author of the book or anything, but it was a little homage to, you know, the author of Treasure of Sierra Madre. So, yes, I'm always constantly being very picky with names. And sometimes, you know, I'll go through and, like in a film noir, I'll take the name of a character and the actor who played him and put those names together and name a character after that just as a little fun.
That's a great idea. Oh, that's a great idea. I love that. That's fantastic. Well, we are past our time, although I have so enjoyed this conversation with you. Really, truly, you know, I could go on forever, but I don't want to bore anyone with my talk. I could listen to you and ask you questions all night, though. I cannot thank you enough for being with me. On Friday, everyone, Lori Rader Day is with me. She's an Anthony Award winner from this past BoucherCon. I can't wait to talk to her to see if she remembers how she blubbered when she got the award. She had no idea where she was. She doesn't remember anyone going up and talking to her. I know she doesn't remember me talking to her. So I can't wait to get her on the show on Friday. Next week, Danny Gardner is on with me, Barry Eisler, James Lee Burke, and Ann Voss Peterson. But tonight, I've had the honor and the pleasure of spending the evening talking to Paul D. Marks. Go find him on Amazon. You can find his website at pauldmarks.com. Paul, it has been a pleasure talking to him. So glad we finally did this. Will you come back again sometime?
I would love to, and thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. I did as well. Thank you so much, Paul. Have a good night. Enjoy the rest of your week. Good night, everybody, and thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night, Paul.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Bye.